Gracious and loving God, as we come together as a body, both here in the chapel and those who have joined Zoom, I just pray that you would fill us with your wisdom as we look into this passage this morning that explores this very challenging dynamic between faith and belief. So as we continue our study in the book of James, we turn our attention this morning to what might be James's most significant contribution. If it's not his most significant contribution, it's definitely his most controversial. It is because of these verses that people like Martin Luther suggested that James probably should not have been included in the canon. And even many modern scholars have suggested that perhaps James is pre-Christian literature. And so whether you're aware of it or not, there's a significant amount of debate relative to the validity of the book of James, and this passage is at the heart and soul of that discussion. And I want to suggest to you this morning that I think that understanding is very misguided. But in order for us to understand this passage, there's a couple of things that we need to talk about first. First, again, James weaves together those three primary threads that make up the heart and soul, the core of this book: trials, wisdom, and wealth. Or poverty. So we see trials in the hardship of a brother and sister who are naked and hungry. We see the issue of wealth and poverty in their very presence. And we see the emphasis in wisdom because of this relationship between faith and works. One of the interesting things about wisdom literature in the Old Testament is that it is very much so focused on this relationship between faith and works. A wise person was someone who, in essence, had a deep and abiding fear of God, and not fear in the sense that they were afraid of God as some sort of ominous, terrible, mean being who was going to, zap them, but fear in the sense of reverence, a loving sort of reverence for God. But the interesting thing is, in wisdom literature, that loving reverence always issued forth in works, in deeds. So when you look at Proverbs, it's all a coming together of a bunch of pithy little sayings that get at issues relative to works, relative to deeds. And so even though James doesn't specifically use the word wisdom, his audience that was predominantly Jewish would have made the connection just like that. That James was introducing and exploring with them the very heart of what it means to be wise. And the wise person was someone who understood and lived out the relationship between faith and works. Second, we need to understand that the distinction that James is drawing in this passage is not a distinction between faith and works, as if one was right and the other is wrong. I would suggest to you that that is a very dangerous distinction that James is actually trying to deconstruct, if you will, in his readers' minds. The distinction that James is drawing is not between faith and works, but between a living faith, a true faith, a faith that issues forth and works and saves, and a false faith or a dead faith that does not issue forth and works and therefore does not save. So it's critical when we come to this passage that we understand that the distinction that James is drawing is not between faith and works. It's between two different kinds of faith. One that is living and true and one that is false and death. And we'll see how that works itself out when we look at the flow of the passage. So in order to explore this distinction then that James is making between living faith, true faith, and false faith, and dead faith, I want us to understand sort of the structure and the flow of his argument. So in verses 14 through 17, he offers us an analogy that he wants to explore with them relative to this distinction. Then second, building on this analogy, he offers us a very rational argument to suggest that there's a difference between living faith, dead faith. And then finally, to drive home his point in verses 21 through 26, he dips into Jewish history, into Jewish faith and life, by first appealing to Father Abraham. Because if you can find it in Father Abraham, then it's got to be real. It's got to be true. It's like Menno Simons, you know, if Menno said it must be right, okay? You know, you understand what I'm saying? So he wants to do that. So he dips into what he refers to as our Father. And if he can prove it there, his point, it's sealed. But then he does something really, really radical. He follows the giant of their faith, Abraham, with Rahab, foreigner, prostitute. And the distinction that he wants to draw and what he's attempting to do, I think it's just absolutely powerful in terms of what it means for our faith and our spirituality. Okay, so let's begin by first looking at this analogy that James opens with. So in verses 14 through 17, James opens his teaching regarding living faith with two very powerful rhetorical questions. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save them? Now, in and through these two rhetorical questions, it's clear that the distinction that James is drawing is not between faith and works, but between a faith that saves and a faith that does not save, or living faith and dead faith. That's his point with that second rhetorical question, can such faith save them? That's the fundamental issue that James is trying to get at. What sort of faith is truly saving faith? Okay, and what he's going to suggest is this faith that does not issue forth in works is not truly a saving faith. No, again, this distinction is not between faith and works. James is, in his opening questioning, it is addressing brothers and sisters. And it's critical to recognize that. This isn't an issue between faith that is in the church and faith that is in the world. He's talking to brothers and sisters about two different kinds of faith that exist within his church community. And within his church community, within his brothers and sisters, there's living faith that is issuing forth in works, and there's dead faith that is not issuing forth in works. That's why it's such a significant issue for James. If this was about faith that's out in the world, he may not be so concerned about it. But this is about faith within his church community, within the lives of his brothers and sisters, and that makes it a very significant pastoral issue for him. Because some of his brothers and sisters, at the very core, do not seem to understand the nature of true faith. That's a big deal. And so, zooming in on that issue, and he's been building it up to it throughout the letter to this point. So in order to make his point, James again appeals to a situation that he more than likely witnessed in his church. A brother or sister are without clothes and daily food. Those are the two telltale signs of extreme poverty in their age and in our age today. A lack of clothing and a lack of food. This person who is naked and hungry may have come to a brother or sister for help, or they may have just been seen by a brother or sister. Either way, the response of the brother or sisters the response of them to this person's poverty lacks deeds. They respond in very pious, very good-sounding ways. They wish them well, which is another way of saying be blessed. So they bless them with their words. They actually hope that they will be warm and well-fed. But they do absolutely nothing for them. And based on this reality that James has seen in the faith and life of his church, he asks the question, what good is that? What good is that response that showers a blessing upon them, that actually hopes that they will be warm and well-fed, but doesn't actually do anything to warm them and feed them? He asked the rhetorical question, what good is that? And the obvious answer is not very good. And then he concludes this with this analogy that just as that person's response to the poor did not issue forth an action, did not address their concrete needs in that situation, in the same regard, faith that does not issue forth an action is useless. So he establishes this analogy. You see this person that has concrete physical needs, and that situation does not issue forth in action. He suggests that useless. And then he goes on and says, from that analogy, a faith that does not issue forth in action is useless. Now, after James's opening analogy, James offers more of what we would consider sort of a rational argument in verses 18 through 20. In these verses, James enters into an imaginary dialogue with an unnamed person who is defending the rightness of faith that does not issue forth in works. Now, this is sort of a tricky passage to interpret, because in ancient cultures at this particular time, this is how they often would teach. They would enter into a dialogue with an imaginary person, and that imaginary person almost always represented a position that they had encountered, for example, either in their church or community. And so James is following this ancient tradition of creating this dialogue with this imaginary person. The problem is the Greek doesn't have quotation marks, and so it's not entirely clear where the imaginary person's argument begins and ends and James begins and ends. And even though that's not entirely clear, the point, almost every commentator says, is crystal clear irregardless of who says what within this dialogue. Okay? This passage can be hard to translate because of that, but the point is very, very clear. This person wants to argue that, in essence, some people have faith and some people have works. Almost as if they're different gifts of God. Some people are blessed with faith, some people are blessed with works. And so I have faith, but I don't have works. And you might have works, but don't have faith. And that's okay, because that's how God has ordered things. That's the basic gist of what this imaginary person is wanting to argue. As in essence, faith and works are different gifts or blessings of God. James first challenges this interpretation by asking them to show their faith without deeds. His first challenge is, show me your faith without deeds. Now think about that for a minute. Is it even possible to exhibit faith to express faith without deeds. Prayer to cultivate faith is action. Coming to church to worship is action. Studying God's word to grow in faith is action. When the first disciples expressed faith in Jesus, they left certain things behind and followed Jesus. The leaving behind and the following were action. Faith in action, faith in deeds, faith in works seem to almost be two sides of the same coin. It is not clear that they can actually be separated, which is the point James makes when he said that he could and would show his faith through deeds. That is the first response. James calls into question the most fundamental issue of whether or not faith can even exist without action. And what he's wanting to suggest is it cannot exist. True faith naturally expresses itself, exhibits itself through action. And I think you see that in conversion itself. It's an action to choose to leave and to follow Jesus. The second argument that James makes gets at what is wrong in terms of his opponent's understanding of the very nature of faith. At a level deeper than the distinction between faith and works, James points out that his opponent's very understanding of faith is skewed. James said to his opponent, "You believe there is one God, good. You believe there is one God, good." Now, this statement that there is only one God is called the Shema and is based on Deuteronomy 6:4 and was the most fundamental confession of faith for a Jewish person. For Jewish people growing up at this particular time, both within Judaism and within the early church, they would have said the Shema the first thing they did in the morning, the last thing before they went to bed. God is one. Not many, one. That was the most fundamental confession of faith. And James' opponent believes that God is one and makes that confession of faith. But is it enough to just exercise intellectual assent to the fundamentals of faith? Is that enough for a person to be saved, to be able to make that confession, to be able to make that intellectual assent and to understand God as one? Is that enough to be saved? In other words, if your theology is really, really good and really, really orthodox, is that enough to be saved? Is it enough to just confess that God is one, or to use more contemporary language, is it enough to believe that Jesus suffered and died for my sins, but not live for Jesus actively in the world? Is that enough? Is that true faith? Is it enough to confess Jesus as Lord and Savior, but never do good in Jesus' name? Is that enough? Is it enough to say the sinner's prayer at camp and grade school and never have that faith issue forth in action? Is that enough? James says no. And to make his point, he offers what I think is an absolutely killer argument. Demons believe that. And they shudder. Demons believe God is one. And they shudder. They actually show action, right? They shudder. That's how ludicrous this is. David's in his commentary on James says that perhaps no being has a more complete understanding of God's character and God's will for humankind than Satan. Satan's theology is better than mine. Satan's theology is better than yours. It's better than Martin Luther's, better than Manuel Simon's. His theology is absolutely impeccable. Satan understands God's character and God's will. And Satan knows God is one, but is Satan saved? I don't think so. It doesn't issue forth in the right kind of action. Think of all of those stories in the New Testament and the Gospels where the demons realize that this is the Son of God and they scream, and they shudder. They know. Just saying that, just even intellectually believing that, is not enough. True faith issues forth in action. James gives two examples of this living faith. And I said the first one is Father Abraham. And many of the people that James would have been arguing with would have went to Genesis 15, where it said that it was credited to Abraham as righteousness. So the idea is that his faith is credited to him. It doesn't issue forth in action. The righteousness is credited to him. James wants to adjust that argument. So what does he do? He goes to the story where Abraham willingly makes his own son sacrifice to God. The very covenant is built on Isaac living and surviving. Everything that Abraham has been following God for, hoping for, praying for, God is now telling him to put it on the altar and sacrifice it to him. And what Abraham does is act. And of course, as we know from the story, God presents a lamb, a sacrifice instead of Isaac. But his faith issued in action. You see exactly the same thing with Rahab. Here's a woman who's a prostitute, not the father of the faith, but we know that in Jewish tradition, she goes on to become the great-great, supposedly, of Jeremiah. And she's included in Jesus's genealogy. And that's pretty high praise for some. And why? James says because this faith that was in some way, shape, or form born in the midst of this experience issued forth in action. She protected the spies and set them home by faith. Now here's the interesting thing. James emphasizes that Rahab showed hospitality to these strangers. And Rahab is praised throughout the Testament that reality showing hospitality. When you look at the book of James, this is not the first or the second, it's at least the third time that we've seen this theme. Showing hospitality. When you look in the Old Testament, look at the story of Exodus, which is the foundation of Israel's very faith, is this God who rescued them, this God who liberated them, we're told in at least four different places that a mixed multitude of people left Egypt. It wasn't just the Jewish people. But also apparently a lot of Egyptians left with them as well. A lot of Egyptians went, I think I want to be on that team. I want to be with that God. And they left with them. And what is emphasized in the story is that the people of Egypt welcomed them. They had been their oppressors, and they welcomed them. They showed hospitality. Their faith issued forth in that most fundamental biblical action, which is hospitality. You see it before the covenant is established, before the law is given. You see this emphasis on God telling the people of Israel, you know what it was like to be oppressed. Welcome the alien and sojourner. Let's care for the orphan widow in your midst. Practice hospitality. And including Rahab and everything that James has done here, to ignore that as the most fundamental sort of initial expression of faith, I don't think we can or should. This is a faith that James is advocating for. It's a faith that is real and viable and centered on Christ, and it issues forth first and foremost in the hospitality. You saw it at the end of chapter 1. You saw it in last week's passage when the wealthy person comes in and the poor person comes in, don't welcome the poor one. And he reminds them that's not how we do things. We see it in the passage today. This trend in James is just going to continue because he wants to emphasize this idea that the most basic expression of our faith is to practice love for people. And I would say, whether that's spiritual or physical or emotional, practice love. Faith issues forth. Next. Gracious and loving God, we do indeed worship and praise you. We thank you for this model of faith that not only blessed us with, continued to counsel us and guide us in, this faith that works. I pray that you would give us the discipline and wisdom, practice, and to grow